Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist Arun Gupta, a founding editor of New York City's independent newspaper, who assesses the Fight for 15 campaign organizing for higher wages at fast food restaurants and big box retailers across the country. Scott Semple, commissioner of the Connecticut Department of Correction, who talks about implementing a more humane and dignified approach to running prisons that makes for a safer environment and better outcomes. And Eve Spangler, associate professor of sociology at Boston College, who discusses her new book titled Understanding Israel-Palestine, Race, Nation, and Human Rights in the Conflict. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Despite warnings issued by the British Labour Party establishment, veteran backbencher and socialist Jeremy Corbyn is the top contender to lead the Labour Party on a strong anti-austerity agenda and skepticism of foreign military intervention. Corbyn, who vows to scrap Britain's Trident nuclear missile program, has a 20-point lead in polls over his rival centrist candidates for party leader. The Labour Party suffered serious losses in the last election against Conservative Prime Minister David Cameron and lost all but one of their seats in Scotland. In a rejection of centrist New Labour fashioned by Tony Blair, Corbyn wants to renationalize key industries. He has also called for a people's quantitative easing, which would mandate the Bank of England to finance large-scale housing, energy, and transport projects with the goal of creating 1 million new skilled jobs. Other candidates for the leadership of the Labour Party accuse Corbyn of wanting to turn the centre-left party back to the pre-Thatcherite 1970s. But Corbyn has surprised many pundits by winning key labour union endorsements, has attracted big crowds, and brought new blood to the Labour Party. Through the campaign, Corbyn has criticized previous Labour governments for promoting economic policies that exacerbate inequality in Britain by favoring the service sector at the expense of traditional blue-collar jobs. Results of the Labour leadership race will be announced on September 12th. Florida's entire Republican establishment, from Governor Rick Scott to U.S. Senator Marco Rubio and former Governor Jeb Bush, all dismiss the threat of man-made climate change to the Sunshine State. Yet Eric Carpenter, head of the Miami Beach Department of Public Works, is paying close attention to tidal surge. He has the latest flood maps and is trying to figure out how many new water pumps the city will need to stop ocean flooding. Local mayors have joined the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Change Compact, which has emerged as a national model. The cities involved in the compact have agreed to make preparations to confront a predicted rise in sea level, identify the most vulnerable flood-prone areas, and are reviewing more than 100 recommendations for action. This initiative is moving forward without any federal or state funding. According to the Christian Science Monitor, Miami Beach is one of America's most vulnerable cities to sea level rise. Even on calm days, water can fill local roadways, creating traffic jams and disrupting commerce. The city is now installing 80 new water pumps at the cost of $400 million to drain rainwater from city streets. Miami Beach Mayor Philip Levine observed, "We are on the tip of the spear. We do not debate the reason why. We just come up with solutions." Resistance from heavy industry and Republicans in Congress has led to a standoff in implementing new occupational health standards, which could endanger the lives of thousands of workers. Over the past 20 years, OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, has issued 7 health standards, in contrast to 6 rules adopted in 1978 alone. According to the Center for Public Integrity, most of OSHA's exposure limits are over 40 years old, and tens of thousands of chemicals, including some that are known hazards, aren't addressed by OSHA regulations at all. While the metal hexavalent chromium emitted during chrome plating and certain welding operations and used in products such as specialty paints can cause cancer, the chromium industry has worked for decades to stop or delay the implementation of regulations. According to documents filed by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the industry spent $500,000 on a health study to call into question earlier research. But when the study found the current exposure limits weren't adequate, the industry suppressed its own findings. Since 2010, worker advocates have been lobbying for the passage of the Protecting America's Workers Act, which would strengthen safety enforcement by increasing civil and criminal penalties. But the measure faces strong opposition by industry-funded politicians, including Minnesota Republican John Klein, chairman of the House Education and Workforce Committee, who has raised nearly $1 million from industry-backed donors. But Dr. Sammy Al-Mashat of Public Citizens Health Research Group doesn't see much difference between Democrats and Republicans when it comes to improving workers' health. He says both parties are essentially corporate-funded. It's infused a culture in the regulatory process of extreme deference to industry. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
It's been almost 3 years since the movement for a living wage burst into protest, first in New York City, and then dozens of other cities and towns across the U.S. In its short lifespan, the National Campaign for a Hike in the Minimum Wage has seen significant victories, including announcements from fast food giant McDonald's and America's largest retailers, Walmart and Target, announcing they would increase the base pay for their lowest paid employees. Elsewhere, 11 states have legislated minimum wage increases, and major cities including Seattle, San Francisco, and Los Angeles have passed measures that will over time phase in a $15 hourly wage. The National Workers Alliance, known as Fight for 15, is backed by the Service Employees International Union, or SEIU, which has initiated other successful organizing drives, including the Justice for Janitors campaign. SEIU has spent millions on organizing major protests, job walkouts, pickets, and a sophisticated public relations campaign designed to move public opinion in favor of minimum wage increases. A recent National Labor Relations Board ruling will make it easier for unions to negotiate contracts for employees working at fast food chains and other companies with franchises using contract labor. Your reporter spoke with Arun Gupta, a founding editor of New York City's independent newspaper and widely published journalist. Here he examines the strengths and weaknesses of the Fight for 15 campaign for higher wages that he's written about in an article titled Wage Gains Won't Last Unless Fight for 15 Builds Worker Power.
SEIU has spent tens of millions of dollars. By my estimate, they've probably spent $50, maybe over $100 million. They put an enormous amount of money into this. Now, to their credit, they have played a key role in terms of moving, getting this movement in terms of the wage. The first place for it to happen was Seattle. A lot of the credit, though, also goes to Socialist Alternative and Shama Sawant, who was elected to the Seattle City Council in the fall of, I believe it was 2013 now. And, you know, SEIU deserves a lot of credit for it. But this is not a worker organizing campaign. This has to be understood as a public relations campaign. It's a march on the media. What they have been very effective at doing is kind of creating a lot of essentially shaping the message, helping shape public opinion. They work with different groups like Labor Projects and National, I think, Employment Law Project. They've come out with all sorts of studies about wage theft. Something like 83% of fast food workers are subjected to one form of wage theft or another. They've come out, you know, with all sorts of, you know, great reports on just, you know, the horrendous conditions fast food workers have to live under, how they depend on billions of dollars in taxpayer subsidies to survive. And so they have really helped shift the opinion. And of course, this is also coming in the wake of Occupy Wall Street, right? It was Occupy that really shifted the debate from economic austerity to income inequality. So that has helped the Fight for 15 tremendously at this point. So now we're finally seeing these victories, and we should not discount them at all. But we have to remember the real principle of worker organizing is building worker power, right? That the workers have to really be the ones who decide and take the initiative. And that's not happening at all. This is very much stage managed. When I talk to organizers and workers themselves, it's like, are you being trained in guerrilla tactics in the shop? How to build, how to organize a shop, how to like build resistance on the shop floor? And virtually none of this is going on across the country. So it's kind of this more staff-driven and very much leadership-driven strategy. There are a few people in SEIU's national office who are essentially making the decisions. Maybe it's half a dozen, maybe it's a dozen people, but it's a small number of people who are really directing the campaign.
From your research for this article, what is the objective? What's the goal of the Service Employees International Union in sinking all this money and organizing time into rallying workers for higher wages? Do they want to win elections and win over dues-paying members, or is there some other objective here?
You know, I talked to one of the senior most labor strategists in the country, and he, you know, on background, filled me in on how campaigns like this operate. And he said there's never one strategy. It's essentially a series of nested strategies that you're trying to push all these things forward at once. So one is that SEIU does want to organize workers. It's very difficult. And now with the NLRB ruling about joint employers, there's finally a path where they may be able to negotiate with the fast food giants. It's still not going to be easy. Part of the thing is they do also want to help improve the condition of workers, but that's also to make them look better. Another strategy is also they're trying to at once curry favor with Democratic politicians, but also show them that they're a force to be reckoned with. This is why they're concentrating in a lot of urban areas. So there are all these different strategies going on at the same time. It's never about any one thing.
Arun, do you find any hope in this workers' movement to go beyond where SEIU is taking them?
We have to, you know, say that this has been a real important victory. Let's not lose sight of that. You know, no one thought $15 an hour was possible when it began. But I will just say it's going to take a lot more. The struggles are more than biological reproduction. As important as wages, housing costs, medical care, all those are, that is not what we, and by we I mean people on the left, socialists, communists, anarchists, are fighting for. We're fighting for a different world, how we think about work, society, community, family relations, gender relations. And you're only going to do that by really creating forms and structures of radical democracy. And this is the last thing SEIU wants to do.
That was journalist Arun Gupta, a founding editor of New York City's independent newspaper. Find more analysis and commentary on the National Movement for a Living Wage by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Connecticut recently made headlines when the state Supreme Court ruled that it was unconstitutional to carry out the death sentences of 11 men on death row after the state abolished the death penalty in 2012. When the legislature passed and the governor signed a bill that banned capital punishment in 2012, the measure exempted those inmates already sentenced to death. But on August 13th, the state's highest court ruled that the death penalty was cruel and unusual punishment, and the 11 men awaiting execution will have their sentences converted to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Connecticut's new commissioner of the State Department of Corrections, Scott Semple, took over as acting director in August 2014 and was confirmed in the post this past January after being nominated by Connecticut Governor Daniel Malloy. He comes to the job with 27 years' experience in the system, beginning his career as a corrections officer, then serving as a warden, and later as the Department of Corrections liaison with the state legislature. Governor Malloy and Commissioner Semple have pushed to repeal mandatory sentences and improve programs to help ex-prisoners find jobs, naming this broader initiative the Second Chance Society. Semple has been hailed by many grassroots criminal justice reform advocates as a man of compassion, a trait they say is sorely lacking in the system in general. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Commissioner Semple after he attended a recent meeting with reform advocates in New Haven. Here he discusses his plans for reform and programs already put into place to make inmates' incarceration more humane and to ease their way back into the community upon release.
And when it comes to wellness, you know, we're talking about some of the things that occur in correctional environments, such as trauma and vicarious trauma and things of that nature. And over time and through experience in general, people take those exposures for granted, but they really have significant impact. So there is some indicators that suggest that you can go in the direction of a more humane and dignified approach with accountability, that you can lower those types of incidents and everyone is better for it, not only the staff, but the inmate population. What you will find in Connecticut and throughout the country in terms of how correctional facilities are designed, I call them stadium construction. You know, when an incident occurs in a correctional facility, everyone gets exposed because everyone is aware of it. It goes throughout the population. There are a lot of things that happen, and I think that we've been going in a direction that takes a more dignified approach in terms of how we manage inmate populations, and we're starting to put some metrics into evaluating as to what we do has an impact and supports those strategic initiatives that I mentioned.
Scott Semple, I understand you recently returned from a visit to Germany to learn about criminal justice there.
About 6 weeks ago, I returned from Germany. I was invited, myself, several other commissioners and advocates, a whole host of professionals to just see and look what the European system looks like. Governor Malloy was there with me, and what we saw was a very dignified environment, and the whole makeup of how they operate, there was some interesting aspects of, you know, their approach. And I did get to see that the vast majority of these folks, when they leave, they are employed. They have the ability to sustain themselves. And I thought that that was attractive. But what was most attractive as it relates to trying to take a dignified approach within correctional facilities is that one of the facilities that we had went to, which would be the equivalent of a level 4 maximum security environment for calendar year 2014, had zero incidents. So that's very limited trauma, if any. So that was extraordinarily attractive to me. So I am still evaluating, you know, what we can do here in Connecticut that may mirror or mimic some of the aspects of how they manage that population. You know, it was worth seeing, and it was worth seeing a system outside of this country. I've seen many systems in this country, so it was very exciting, and there were some interesting things that they do with the juvenile population there, which is primarily 18 to 25 years of age, and they really focus on the whole discussion about brain development. And I think as our population lowers, we may be able to entertain some of the theories that go along with that.
There have been recent attempts to scale back the numbers of Americans, especially men and women of color, who are incarcerated. Where does Connecticut fit in that effort?
You know, historically, we know that there's some people refer to it as hyper-incarceration or mass incarceration. It definitely has been a huge financial burden on state budgets, federal budgets, and alike, county budgets. Connecticut's unique because it's a consolidated system. I have an obligation, and our agency has an obligation, to be responsive to the taxpayers, and that is the direction that I received from our governor to try to have an impact on this population in terms of his launching of the Second Chance Act. It's very, very expensive to incarcerate people in Connecticut, not only in Connecticut, but throughout the nation. And if you just have a 5% reduction in recidivism just within corrections, that equates to about $12 million in savings. That's a substantial amount of money, but if you take it even further, there are other savings, you know, within local government and things of that nature, when, you know, police and all different types of public safety entities that could be a cost saving as far as a social impact as well. It is about creating law-abiding citizens, but it's also about and sustainable incomes, but people have to feel better about themselves. It's just not get a job, and that solves the problem. If that was the case, this initiative would be a lot easier to address.
That was Scott Semple, Commissioner of the Connecticut Department of Correction. For more information and analysis of Connecticut's innovative corrections programs, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. While world attention understandably has been focused on the bloody wars in Syria, Iraq, Libya, and Yemen that have produced a massive wave of immigration to Europe, not seen in many decades, the intractable Israeli-Palestinian conflict goes on. Flashpoints of violence between Israelis and Palestinians rise to the surface on a regular basis, symbolizing the failure of multiple international efforts to resolve this conflict since the founding of Israel as a nation-state in 1948. The senseless death of three members of a Palestinian family in the West Bank village of Douma is but one of many similar incidents. A firebomb attack on the home of the Dawabsha family on July 31st is thought to have been carried out by Jewish extremists, but no one as yet has been charged with the crime. The latest member of the family to die was 27-year-old Riham Dawabsha, mother of 18-month-old Ali, who died on the day of the attack. 8 days later, his father, Saad, also died. Ali's 4-year-old brother, Ahmed, is still being treated in hospital. A new book written by Eve Spengler, associate professor of sociology at Boston College, explores the decades-long Israeli-Palestinian conflict by examining important chapters of that complex history, the concepts of Zionism, anti-Semitism, liberation, and possible new paths to a negotiated settlement. Your reporter spoke with Professor Spengler about her book, titled Understanding Israel-Palestine, Race, Nation, and Human Rights in the Conflict. Here she discusses some essential truths about the conflict, of which many Americans are unaware, and a possible human rights framework that could lead to a resolution of the long-standing conflict.
So let's start with Israel and Palestine together are a little bit larger than the size of New Jersey. There are about 12 million people there, almost exactly evenly divided, 6 million Israeli Jews and 6 million Palestinians, some of them Christian, most of them Muslim. And so we're confronted with a kind of paradox. Under, you know, theories of democracy, you have communities, each of whose individual members is of equal human worth. Human rights doctrine has to start with the worth and dignity of each individual. And two communities of roughly equal size, 6 million each. This could be a formula for democratic, peaceful, prosperous living together, but instead these relatively equally worthwhile individuals in equal-sized communities are confronted with this terrible paradox. One is an occupier and one is the occupied. The occupier has a modern Western technology state with a high standard of living, with unlimited American diplomatic, military, and financial support. And the other group are stateless people, in the case of the almost 2 million who live in Gaza, probably also mostly homeless people. And this struggle between an occupier to expand and maintain an occupation and an occupied people to come to some more just terms to live an ordinary life, that is the paradox of Israel-Palestine.
Eve, I wanted to ask you about the consensus that has been built since the 70s, mm-hmm. Around a two-state solution, mm-hmm. from Jimmy Carter and Anwar Sadat to Clinton and Obama. A lot of the negotiating sessions that have been held between Israelis and Palestinians over the years has been around a two-state solution. It seems that in the last couple of years, there's a recognition that this may be a dead end, not least of which is the continuing failure to reach anything like a two-state solution. Benjamin Netanyahu publicly declared his opposition to the two-state solution, coming out of the closet on that one. Eve, maybe you can explain what the alternative to a two-state solution is among activists in Israel and Palestine, and yourself, too, who have gravitated towards a different way forward for a solution.
On the left, there has been some thought among leading Palestinian intellectuals that the Palestinian quest for a normal and decent and fair life needs at some point to abandon the framework of a national liberation struggle. They need to say to Israelis, hey, you know what? You've won. You've got all the land. You've got all the aquifers. You've got all the roads. And hey, guess what? You've got all of us, too. Now, where do we sign up for voter registration? Where do we sign up for our national health insurance card? So there are some Palestinian intellectuals who've thought that way, and they have undertaken to work with Israeli intellectuals who agree with them. And so there's a lot of work going forward, very quietly, never covered on the media, about what would water look like in a one-state solution? What would land rights look like? How many refugees really could return? Where would the roads go if they weren't only connecting illegal settlements back to Israel proper? How would you have a grid that served everybody? How would you have a power grid that served everybody? So a lot of that planning is already going forward on the left, and that's what I've gravitated toward. Because the two-state solution was really never enthusiastically endorsed by either Zionists or Palestinians.
Well, Eve, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you this one last question, and that revolves around the major point that you've raised in this book, and that is that you believe that to move forward to a long-term peaceful solution in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, we have to start in the framework of human rights. And although we don't have a lot of time, maybe you could spell that out for us.
Absolutely. I think human rights are valuable in their own right because they insist on the dignity and worth of individuals. They're also, I think, important to us because they're looking toward the future. The premise is everybody who's here gets to stay here. No one gets pushed into the sea. Now, how do we do it so that everybody gets treated decently? And lastly, I think human rights are important because they do require some action. The truth is not halfway between Martin Luther King and the Ku Klux Klan. The truth isn't halfway between the Union and some sweatshop owner. The truth is the truth, and it needs to be stood up for. So I think human rights gives us a place to stand without being Middle East experts, without speaking all the languages, but knowing some of the history. It gives us a place to stand, at least to ask that America use the standard of human rights in relation to this conflict.
That was Eve Spangler, Associate Professor of Sociology at Boston College and author of the book Understanding Israel-Palestine, Race, Nation, and Human Rights in the Conflict. Find more views on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikita. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.